What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Yalla, your thrice weekly podcast where we talk about the hottest news, sometimes with some very interesting people, all with a touch of what, Terrence?
Good old humor.
Good old humor, man.
Yeah.
Today is one of those special episodes.
Yeah.
Where we have a special guest in front of us.
Correct.
Someone who we have worked with previously. We have known for quite a while.
I would still really, really want to be able to work with her creatively on one of our productions. Right?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
And it is none other than actor Un Shu An. What's up, Shu An?
What's up? Good to be here.
Yeah.
I really love this setup.
Maybe you can tell our listeners how you described it when you first heard it. What was the word you used?
A very special word.
I said it was cute.
Cute.
And they're like, that's not the look that we're going for. But I think it's so great. You got your fairy lights, you got neon lights, you've got this tent in the middle of a room. It's so great.
It's like glamping. We're glamping in the office already, right?
Yeah. It's a vibe, man.
And like everything has been added like in layers. There was a base. I mean, first there was the tent.
Okay.
Then some of the acoustic cushions. Then the blankets or like the acoustic treatment we layered on after a while.
Yeah.
Then this show.
We
grabbed this poster board before the office closed down because they were going to chuck it and we're like, fuck that, we want it in our office.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, this is very interesting because I feel like, I mean, it's such a huge achievement for you guys. Also really painful one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How do you hold those two things together? Because like, for me, it would feel like a bad reminder in some sense, but you guys also did such great work on it.
So
how do you hold like both those realities?
Wow, the podcast guest has turned it on us.
No, it's an interesting topic. Right? I mean, I kind of think of it like a bad relationship, for example. It happened to you. It shaped who you are as a person today. But does it necessarily mean that you don't want, if you could go back in time and just not have that whole experience at all, would you choose not to have it? Right? I'm not saying that this was a bad relationship. I'm just saying that You hold those two. You kind of understand who you are is molded by your experiences, right?
Wow.
And you kind of just, that's how it was. That's how the ships fell. And you,
so
you
if you went back and had a choice knowing all that you do now, would you do it again?
Knowing that we'd get screwed over and turned upside down by the whole thing, that's tricky. That one's tricky. Because I think that the business aspect of things, it doesn't just affect you creatively. It affects your, financial well-being.
Yeah.
I mean, that means it affects you and your family as well and all. So now, having family and all, I got to think of bigger picture. But you, Harish, this is an interesting question.
I would say no. Because... No, like whether I would do it knowing everything that was going to come. Because, I mean, to your first question about why we keep it in this room, because it was a dark time for us. It was very tough to get through. But at the same time, we are super proud of the work. So for us, we're like, we're not just going to let it die anonymously. We're like, fuck it, we made this. This is almost like something that we salvage from the burning ship that liquidated. And we're like, no, this is our thing. And there was also a lot that we learned from it. Personally, business-wise. But whether we would do it again, I think those lessons could have been learned otherwise, other ways.
Because it was a bit less pain.
Pain, hopefully same outcome or something, because that period was it was tough, and it was COVID also. But certain great things came out of it, like this podcast. Forced us to do this because we couldn't do anything else. The folklore service that we now have also came about from this podcast. And now we look back, we still made the show. We released it on YouTube. So we move on. I mean, still the consequences of that we're still dealing with, but we move on.
I really admire you guys, man.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Like, it's so hard to pick yourself up after that. And to also, I feel like you guys do it with such optimism in some ways, or drive. Maybe, I mean, obviously I don't see the stuff behind the scenes, but it also feels like every time I interact with you, there's always this all right, let's do it. This is a new idea. Let's go. Folklore is also such a great idea. Getting people to record their stories, getting people to record the stories of people in their lives. That's really beautiful and so important, and not a lot of people get that kind of opportunity.
Thank you for that. And I think partly also one big reason is because we still do believe so much in the talent in Singapore. Both like from entities that create content, from content creators, from actors such as yourself. So I think there's so much potential, and it'll be a waste to not just keep trying.
Of course,
it comes with a lot of things you have to sacrifice or balance, but it feels like, yeah, there's still momentum, and feels like generally we're all moving in some direction.
Yeah.
Maybe slow, maybe faster sometimes, but feels like this is not dying. It's not dying.
And I mean, it's quite a compliment coming from you, because I think even for myself, just knowing your background and your history and all, you've always been seen as one of the more daring artists, right? That have come along.
I don't know.
I mean, daring in the sense of like pioneering new things, you know, different mediums, appearing, you know, in a big Netflix production before, you know, Netflix was even like what it is today and things like that, right? So, I mean, actually, we want to talk a bit about that. One of the reasons we get you here is because, yeah, like, you have a very, very storied history in the Singapore media scene.
Okay,
right?
The life of Shu En, chapter one.
Honestly, sometimes I also like, I don't feel like I've done a lot, and I also don't really feel like, I don't know, like sometimes you look back and it's like you forget a lot of the things that you do, but also I also don't feel like, I don't know, I just feel the same in certain ways about a lot of things.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Just like plodding along, doing a thing.
Because you've been in the industry for how many years? Like what's the TLDR of your journey into media?
Okay, my parents sent me to speech and drama classes when I was very young, like when I was like 5 or 6 or something. And then because I was very shy, then they wanted me to talk. So they sent me for speech and drama classes. And then I guess like I really loved it. And then in my primary school, there was no drama. I joined drama when I was in secondary school, and I just really enjoyed learning through scripts, through stories, through other people. And I think that was what drew me most, because it was very hard for me to learn through books. So learning through stories and interactions with other people was the way that I experienced the world. So then that continued, and then I went to JC. I didn't do well. I got retained in my first year. I was also in a drama club there. I got retained in my first year, and then after that I still didn't do well. And then I applied, I think, for like the big three in Singapore, and I didn't get in. And then my friend told
the big three universities.
And then I didn't get in, and then my friend told me about the acting course at LaSalle. And they just started the BA acting course. I think it was going to be in its second year when I joined, and so I just went for the audition, and then I got in, and I was like, okay, here we go. Yeah, but I never thought that it would be like my full-time job. So then but then after I went to acting school, then it kind of was like, so then I just continued and started doing stuff. After that, when I came out, before that I was also doing commercials, like TVCs.
Model or talent?
Like a talent. So I was doing TVCs, and I also did this film called Becoming Royston. I think in like when I was like 19 or something. And then after that, I went to LaSalle. So then when I was in LaSalle, I was still doing some work outside, like shoots and stuff. And then I also started doing like short films, which I love. I love doing short films. I love working with students, actually.
Okay.
I think it's very exciting. It's very freeing in some sense, and it's also got this energy that is very
anything's
hard.
Possible.
Anything is possible, you
they
know.
They haven't had the life beaten out of them yet, la, right? By the industry.
Bright eyes.
Yeah, but that's great. You know, like if you could find a way to hold on to that kind of energy to create from that space, like imagine the kind of work that you could do.
You know
what I mean? Like it's so much, it's so fun. So I really love working with students. And it's also, I feel like it's also very important, right? Like, because we were all young creators once, and someone gave us a chance. You know what I mean? So I think that, I mean, I don't think I'm giving them a chance. They're also giving me a chance, but I don't know how to say it. But as in like, I mean, I've done some really, really great student films, and I remain friends with them for many years after that, and they've grown so much in their career, and it's so incredible to see like where they go. And to be like, oh my God, do you remember we knew each other like how many years ago? And I feel like it's such a joy to have people in your life who knew you from a different time. Almost. You know what I mean? Like sometimes people will be like, oh, I remember you when you were in the Girls Brigade. And I'm like,
oh.
Wow.
So would you say those people could see you ending up in media as an accomplished actor?
I don't know. I guess because I was always acting in school. So also I was in the drama club and I was also in Girls Brigade. So I don't know, maybe, I'm not sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's so fun to see like people grow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I was doing student films and then I came out, I was doing, I did this like physical theater thing for a while. I was one of the founding members of this group called Theater Strays. And then we did it's like avant-garde movement stuff.
Okay.
It was so great though. It was like, I feel like it's aside from the style, it was one of the foundations of like my training as an actor, because it really connected me with my body and allowed me to express through movement and discipline. Like the discipline was really great also in that. And then what else? I can't remember. Then I started doing TV stuff and then I started doing film, and so it just kept going. And then I was introduced to the internet. So I was hired as a host by Click Network to do Try and Test It, which was like, oh my God, such a big part of my life. Someone came up to me that day and she said, oh, I went to find like the first episode of Try and Test It. You know how long ago it was?
9 years? 10 years ago?
12 years.
Wow.
Fuck, right? 12 years. And I was like a baby at that time. And I remember I went into the audition. I came out going like, yeah, I'm not going to get that. Because I didn't know anything about beauty. I mean, I knew basic makeup, but I wasn't like a beauty girl, you know? And at that time, YouTube beauty shows were like in their infancy. There was like Michelle Phan. She was like the queen.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But there weren't a lot.
Yeah.
You know? And then so I would watch them. Oh, and another one, who else? I can't remember now. But then it was like, it was not a lot of them, right? Yeah, and then so everything I learned, I kind of like learned from her. And then I went to, I remember it was like Guardian or Watson's, one of them. And I found one of those like random products that can remove wrinkles in like five 1 minute or something like that. And I always fall for this kind of stuff. Like, my mom says my ears are very soft. So you can talk me into a lot of things. Because I'll be like, really? So it's, I'll see that and go like, wow, that could really work. So I bought that to try. And then I can't remember what it was like, but it was just...
Wait, did it work?
No.
Oh, it didn't work.
Nothing can remove your wrinkles for like in 1 minute. I don't think so. Unless it's like Botox or something. Yeah, but there's always a hope.
Yeah.
There's always a hope. Yeah. I mean, who knows, one day. Yeah, so I came out of the audition thinking that I wouldn't get it. And then I did. And then that opened up my eyes to like the world of the internet, which was really incredible. Yeah.
And you did it for how long?
Okay, I think we stopped off, I don't know, like maybe 2-3 years ago. So maybe about 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
So how did that kind of look? Because you were involved in so many different formats.
Yeah.
You had started doing theater by then as well, right?
I grew up in a theater.
You grew up in a theater.
Yeah. And then I started doing TV.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then I started doing film. So I was doing like hosting for TV as well. I hosted like some art shows. But then hosting for TV is so different from hosting for the internet.
Yeah.
I still remember the first day we went to shoot, I went in and I started doing my TV hosting. And then, but that was so different from my audition, right? And then G was kind of, I remember she was like a bit stunned. She was like,
This is Jillian. Jillian, the founder.
So Click was like the OG YouTube channel. Yeah.
First to hit a million subscribers in Singapore.
Yeah. She did so much. She's an incredible woman. Yeah, so capable and just really smart and really just, she's got her finger on the pulse, right? You know what I mean? So yeah, it was really interesting because I remember I came in and then I went into my TV hosting voice. And
which is what?
Hi, welcome to this episode of Tried and Tested. This is Shuella. And then she was like, let's try that again, maybe.
Very politely.
Maybe be yourself. And the thing is, like on TV, people always say be yourself. But they don't mean it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's a TV version of yourself that they want you to be, right?
Yeah.
I feel like the internet opens a different side of like really just being yourself. And I think it took time for me. So I'm going to redo that. Okay, so I feel like on TV, people always say like, be yourself, but it's like a TV version of yourself, right? And that's fair. I think we all have different versions of who ourselves who ourselves is in front of whoever, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. then with the internet, I had to kind of find like what that was, I think. And then so I think it was like, we tried a few times and then finally she was like, okay, yeah, that wasn't the audition. He was like, what happened? She was like, I just remember the first time I was like, oh no, I'm fucking it up. I'm messing this up so bad. She's just going to fire me. Mm. Yeah. But
then it lasted for like 10 years, right?
Yeah.
So then how did you find like doing all the different formats? Do you think they complemented each other or you almost felt like you were in very different worlds?
That's a very good question. I think for me, like people always ask like, oh, do you like TV or film better? And I feel like it depends on the people.
Mm.
Yeah, so I feel like in that sense, I don't feel it that differently. But definitely in different mediums, there's a different way of engaging with the audience, a different way of engaging with the material, with the people you are on screen with, on stage with, or whatever. So there is a different language for each of them. And I feel like I kind of learn from each one, and they do kind of like feed each other in that sense, I feel. Yeah.
Mm.
Like the internet, for example, is the fact that it's so immediate and it's so eternal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's like, it's there. And then people leave comments and they can leave comments as fast as like a second after you upload it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
there's a reaction like so fast after it goes up.
Mm.
And then it's there. And then people in the comments can relate to each other. They can talk to each other. And you can talk to them if you want to. So there's something quite magical about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what brought you guys to YouTube?
Because you know what I mean? Too old to do anything to get into traditional media.
What do you mean? That's nonsense. What does that mean?
To a certain extent, that's part of the story.
Oh, what do you... Okay, tell me.
I mean, you're thinking about the, 2010, 2011... that period, it's still, media, the media industry, you got to join a TV network and, get signed on as an artist or a DJ or something.
Right.
So there were no non-traditional routes into, to break into the industry. But then this thing called YouTube came around and like what you're saying, beauty YouTubers, but there were also YouTubers doing short films and sketches and everything and putting them online. And comedic sketches, and even SNL at that point was like experimenting with shorts and things like that.
Mm.
So in fact, our first few YouTube videos were, comedy sketches. I think we talked about music videos and stuff like that as well, right?
Talked about
about doing funny music videos. Yeah. So we were also trying to see how we could use the medium to sort of like create a brand for ourselves in the industry.
Yeah.
So I would say, we didn't have a face. At least I didn't have a face for TV at that point of time. So I was trying to use other mediums to try to work. I came from a corporate background.
Right.
So to suddenly say, I want to do like something in the media industry, how am I going to break in? Am I going to go back to film school and spend, years there or whatever? It would take me a lot longer than if I just like, okay, you know what, fuck it. Just try whatever I can right now with whatever resources we have. And see what happens.
And we were trained in related fields, Terrence in finance, me in engineering, very related to to media.
That relevant. Seems like a natural progression.
Yeah, natural progression. Yeah, spreadsheets
absolutely.
And all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, I think for us, it was less of the end goal being traditional TV. It just felt like we both had an interest in comedy. We both, if you grew up in the 90s, like TV in Singapore was like, almost like the golden era,
Oh my goodness!
You go back
the
from school, you
so
run
great.
And all. But then, because of the ease of access to other content from other countries, in the 2000s, it felt like the magic of the TV was gone. So we were we would bitch about it at other people's weddings. Then YouTube came out. We're like, okay, let's just try, It feels like we can get a video out on YouTube much faster than we can get an acting role in a show.
Right.
So we just try, But I mean, nobody gave a shit about our first 10, 15 videos.
And but when we talk about YouTube, when I hear you talk about YouTube, it's kind of, I also feel the same, where it felt like something from past life, like something that we feel quite distant from.
Mm.
Although now our podcast is on YouTube and we have a lot of subscribers discovering us through YouTube.
Mm.
But it's a very different era, that kind of like YouTube creation,
It's so different, right?
Very different.
The
very
landscape
different.
Has changed so much.
Yeah. Now it really feels like YouTube is an ecosystem, it's a business, you got to think about it strategically.
Absolutely.
Whereas back then, it was really like anything goes, right?
Yeah. But it was also wonderful because it was like the great democratizer.
It was.
Because then the gatekeeping was...
No algorithms and shit like that. Yeah.
Correct. And it was so... I feel like that era of the internet, sound like an old woman, but I feel like the era of the
in
internet,
my days.
But I thought it was really beautiful because like anybody could be discovered,
yeah,
and you would have no idea.
Even with a webcam, right?
With a webcam, like it didn't need to be high production value. It just it didn't need to kind of like fit into a certain mold of like content or whatever you would call it. And there was a way for people. I mean, like there were what you would call like the weird people. But I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean it in a good way. You know what I mean?
Unique, as in, quirky people.
The quirky people, yeah. They were people who didn't fit into any specific kind of mold and they would find an audience. And I feel like with the way social media is now, it's making more and more difficult for people who sit outside of like a certain kind of look or like rhythm or type of content or whatever to kind of find any sort of eyeballs, which is, I feel like, quite sad because that was the whole point of like the internet at that point, that people who wouldn't fall within certain ways of existing in the world would be able to find people like them, you know, and but I'm not sure if that exists.
You don't see that on TikTok, like, you know, I mean, TikTok, like you can really find people with their niche, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they have very specific niches, but something that I find, okay, I'm not on TikTok. I just watch, but I love watching. Okay. I learn so much on TikTok. Like, I learn how to make like random recipes and just like, cause I can't cook, but like, I like to assemble things. So I always find these like hacks, like assemble this in 1 minute. I'm like, okay, I'm there. Yeah. It's
so
fun.
So you call like making food assembling food?
Yeah, because I feel like the whole, I mean, some people like full on recipes and I'm like, yeah, that's not happening.
You assemble.
I assemble.
Assembling my meal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also like, I have people I say to feed other people. Yeah, but I like to like just randomly like play in the kitchen and come up with stuff. Right. So, so on TikTok, when you watch the videos, I feel like maybe part of it is that the algorithm also feeds you stuff that kind of looks like what you're interested in. So then after a while, everything looks kind of like they're different. I'm not trying to like discount the amount of like work or creativity that goes into the things that people put out, but that the algorithm does encourage people to kind of create content in a certain way and encourages them by rewarding that kind of content.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And then when you are on a scroll, you realize that, oh my God, I'm watching a lot of videos that kind of look the same, but are just a little bit different from the previous thing that I saw. Yeah. So it trains us to stop being able to accept things that are just slightly different. Mm. So I feel like it's going back to before when YouTube started, where, you know, there was a homogeneity about things, which is, I don't know, I feel like we're being trained to be consumers.
Mm. Oh yeah, definitely.
Right? Like, and
I think everyone knows that moment when you're on TikTok and suddenly you realize, oh fuck, like I'm down the wormhole.
Yeah.
And you almost need to refresh your history and all that because you keep seeing the same types of videos.
Yes, but it's by design.
Yeah, it's by design.
Which is problematic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But on one hand, it gives you maximum joy.
Does it?
What kind of joy?
I mean, the dopamine hits.
Yeah,
if it knows what you want.
Yeah.
Let's say like you like assembling a certain kind of like a meal or something and you can just do that every day. Wouldn't that make you happy? Sure. Mm.
I guess. But then there's also the thing, I mean, that's what happens to addicts, right?
Oh, yeah. You need a hit, bigger and bigger hit.
Yeah. It's training, creating addicts.
Yeah, yeah.
And, exactly, and there have been studies about this. Right? Yeah, I'm not just like pulling this out of my ass. Yeah,
And I mean, like the analogy I heard last time is like the beauty of the newspaper is that you can read the news you want, but you might see this article that you wouldn't otherwise see, and it can open up your mind to something you're not normally subscribed to. Whereas like now my news feeds also, like if I go on, I don't know, even like LinkedIn or Twitter, it's all stuff that I have actively kind of like curated.
Yeah.
So I don't see the random offshoot of this story. And in fact, I have to subscribe to things that give like alternative views just to keep, make sure that I'm not going down an echo chamber.
Right.
Which after a while is just difficult to do.
So interesting. Yeah.
If let's say a young Xuan was starting out in the industry today.
Yeah.
Like what would your advice be to, you know, break into the industry? Would it be to set up a TikTok account and start posting there, or what would it be?
Don't do it, find another job.
Wow, that's the most inspirational quote.
Yeah.
No lah, I mean, honestly, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I genuinely don't know.
But you must get people asking you all that all the time, right?
I never answer.
Oh, you never answer?
Yeah.
How do you just keep quiet?
Um, I mean, sometimes people are like, oh, can we have a chat about this? And I'm like, yeah. I don't think I can. Like,
I mean, like asking you advice on how to get into the industry or something.
It sounds very gatekeepy, but it's not, you know, like I think I have a lot of feelings about the industry and about the media landscape in Singapore that I haven't kind of figured out yet. So I also don't really know how to say anything of use.
Mm.
Yeah, and without getting angry.
I see.
Yeah, but which just sounds horrible. But I'm very grateful for the career that I have. Don't get me wrong. And I think that we are surrounded by a lot of really, really talented people.
Mm.
And I think that there are so many possibilities. But then, I think there's a lot of stuff that I think about that I don't know if we can get in. Like, I don't know if I want to get into it right now because that would be the same thing. You know, I feel like I'm still, after so many years, I feel like I'm still processing how I feel about it.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you said that you want to give like new directors or young directors chances, like, right, by working.
Yeah, actually, I shouldn't frame it that way. I don't mean it that way. Because I don't really mean it, but I want to work with people in that kind of space.
Mm.
I want to work with people who just want to try.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I feel like the interesting thing about school projects, which I've generally found, is that usually they're all on the same team in that they all need their final year project to go well.
Correct. Yeah.
So they're really aligned in that sense. Yeah, you know what I mean? Mm. Whereas, like, I feel like on shoots, I mean, it's fine. It's totally okay. That's just the way it is, right? Because we also cannot be expected to give our whole lives to our work. I mean, some people do, some people don't. I don't think that that's the right way to do it.
Mm.
But I think that when it comes to like student projects, everybody is very aligned in terms of everyone needs this to go well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And sure, you're always going to get people, but that's in any team. I feel you're going to always going to have people who maybe differently aligned.
Yeah.
But I think they also find a way to kind of like sort that out.
I get what you're saying, in the sense that if you're talking to somebody who already is producing a show or directing a show, and then they're asking you to come along for the ride, you're like, sure, you know you're new and I'll help you out. But if someone who's like completely fresh and doesn't know anything about industry suddenly comes to you and says, oh, I want to become famous or something, then you would tell them to maybe think a bit more about what their motivation is going to it. Is that
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure.
I'm saying it from my perspective, like, in the sense that as a content creator, or even if you want to be a filmmaker and everything, right? Like, as we saw from our TV example, there's a lot of things in industry that are out of your control that can derail your career, right? You know? But if you still want to pursue it creatively, you will never... I mean, there's nothing else you can do that will scratch that itch, and you have to do it. You have to do it.
Right.
But, you know, you got to understand what the constraints are, you know, our local industry, our media industry, and you know, the size of our country and things like that. And if you still want to do it, then power to you, you know, just go ahead and do it. That's what I think. How do you feel about it, Harish?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, just some of the things you're saying, kind of, like, I agree in the sense that it's very easy to get jaded about the media industry because there are so many roadblocks, there are so many, and sometimes it feels like it's not even a priority for our country, which can be quite demotivating. But at the flip side, what is motivating is when you see people really trying to do stuff different or who are just trying new things. And I guess that kind of like is similar to what you're saying about student projects, where it more often than not, it is just about the best possible piece of content.
Mm.
It's not about the messaging, the budgeting, the finance, the distribution and all that.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but like that's what sometimes I feel. Like, I think the pursuit of like the best possible content is the ideal, but it almost feels like it's tough to maintain that or be focused on just that the longer you are in this industry, because it is a livelihood, and in Singapore and maybe less mature industries where you don't get like success stories where you can really see people make it, you know.
Right.
And it almost feels like everyone in media, it's just about surviving or doing stuff that they are not the most passionate about, which pays the bills.
But I feel like there are people who have like really done really, really well. And I feel like then there's also the other question of like, how do we view success, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. See, so as you are saying all these things, I'm like, I don't know how to respond because like some of it makes sense to me, but some of it I also don't really agree with. But then I can tell you how I feel. Like when I hear some of those things, I can feel like that.
the...
Yeah, and that's also
at,
why...
At me or like at the thing?
No, at gen- in general. Oh, not at you, not at you.
In my face or
something. If it's at you, I will tell you.
I'm very sure of that. I'm very sure. Yeah.
But it's just very, like, it's hard to kind of pick apart. And I think, like, even with, like, say, like, the young director thing, right? I also don't really feel that I'm helping. Because I feel like it's just part of our ecosystem that needs to grow. Do you know what I mean? It's part of, like, working with, like, people whose ideas you resonate with and whatever age they are, like, whatever, like, whatever, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know. I don't know how to say. That's how I feel. That's why, like, honestly, when people ask, like, I do feel very bad because it sometimes feels like, is it I don't want to help you? But it's not. I will help in different ways and, but I really don't know how to have that conversation because it just makes me so, like, I don't know. I don't even know what the word is for it. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like the good thing is that I know how I want to work now. Like, I know what kind of people I want to work with. I know what kind of environments I want to work in. Obviously, I can't get that all the time. You know, but I feel like it's, like, people always ask, oh, what's your goal? I've never had this dream of, oh, okay, I'm going to, like, achieve this. Like, I'm going to do how many films or how many shows or how many whatever by this time. I'm going to do how many. That has never even been on the list. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So, I don't know. That's why I don't know.
So, that means what keeps you going? Is it like what you said, the people you work with? Because you are literally in the middle of a production right now.
I am, yeah.
Which we were supposed to talk about at some point.
Can we think of all the part? No, no, no.
No, that was great. Because, and why I wanted to bring up the show now, because I think it's like I wouldn't say it's restricted just to media. It's very easy to get jaded with things as you get older.
Right? I wouldn't say that I'm jaded though.
Oh yeah, so I'm not saying for you specifically because I sometimes feel jaded.
Right.
But the like what you were saying about how maybe people might hear you and think, oh, like, is she jaded? I don't know. But the fact is that you are still doing a lot of cool shit. One of which is the play right now. So
yeah,
it's not stopping you from pursuing your craft, lah. Am I like no? You're shaking your head.
Maybe we have this conversation outside of the podcast. I don't know what you're gonna put inside.
But I mean, then how did this show come about?
Oh, okay. So this show that we're talking about now is called Tartuffe. It's by Wild Rice. It's written by Joel Tan and it's directed by Glenn Gwee. And I'm working with some incredible people. So it's a modern adaptation of a 350-year-old French play by Molière called Tartuffe. Yeah.
That's a very different vibe from like 2 minutes ago.
Because like that's exactly why I don't want to talk, like, because I don't want to be passing off that energy. Like, if I haven't figured out what I feel about it, if I haven't figured out how I want to talk about it, I don't see the sense in talking to anyone else about that. Do you know what I mean? Because that's genuinely just how I feel. Like, and it's like, I can think about that but still function. Yeah. But when I think about that, it's like, I have nothing of value to offer you right now. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have nothing of value here.
Actually, like, it might not be in the things that you say, but the fact that you are feeling that also, it kind of is assuring to me.
Oh, is it? Yeah, why?
Because, like, I mean, we've been in this industry for, like, 12 years kind of thing.
Right.
And I do look at you as someone who's like, oh, shit, doing cool shit, like, super talented. But the fact that you're feeling it, it also makes me feel less shitty when I feel it.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah, so I think like talking about it, like even though you might not be saying stuff that you think is valuable, I think the reality is because like let's face it, like with social media and all, the media sometimes can be over glamorized. Like the life of someone in media. But there's a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes that people don't really talk about.
I guess. But then a part of me is also a bit like, okay, I don't know why I'm gaslighting myself. But then part of me is also like every job has its own kind of like every job has its own bugbears, is that the word? Yeah, you know, every job has its own like set of difficult things every job has its own systems within which they're working. And
But I mean, that is also a reality that you start to realize, because there's that one saying, right? You know, find something you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Oh, which I hate that saying so much.
Yeah, it's bullshit.
It's like, fucking bullshit.
It's absolute bullshit.
Yeah.
And I think it's important people acknowledge that every job, no matter how glamorous or awesome it sounds, will have these sort of things to deal with.
Like. Yeah. And also, I feel like I don't believe in following your passion, you know. Like, not as a job. It's very weird because I guess like in a capitalist system, it's like we're always like taught that everything that we do has to be for money. I mean, obviously we need money to survive, right?
Yeah.
But like your passion doesn't need to be your job. And there's no shame in that. Yeah. And your job can just be your job and you can follow a passion outside of that. You know, like I've never really resonated with that saying. Yeah. I think it's important to find things that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then for
because
you,
given, humans, yeah.
I'm sure you're passionate about acting.
No.
No.
Oh.
I mean, like, I love doing my job well.
Yeah.
I love learning. I love, like, going deeper into the craft. I love, I love acting. I feel like I'm passionate about connecting with people. And I feel, I think I'm passionate about creating with people. And I'm passionate about conversations. I'm passionate about exploring ideas. I don't know what job that is, but you know what I mean. But it doesn't have to be, right? You know what I mean?
Like,
But I think that's the part that really drew me to acting in the first place, because I'm okay with being on stage, but it's not like
it almost makes everything else that you're passionate about happen.
I don't know. There are things that I enjoy about it, but if you ask me, like, what's my favorite part of the whole thing, is always the rehearsals.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I love the rehearsals. The rehearsals are like the most interesting part for me. I mean, stage is interesting because it's like every time a new audience comes in, they react differently to stuff. And then you kind of like find new things in the text and find new things in the way you relate to each other. So that's really exciting.
But I mean, just echoing what Harish was saying, like, I mean, we've been in this line for very long. And I think the mere act of surviving for this long, surviving through YouTube coming up and then, you know, scandals and, you know, the whole community, like, sort of like falling apart, like, YouTube community.
Oh, wow.
And then now, you know, like, then doing TV shows and then surviving a liquidation. And then now, you know, riding the podcast wave and everything. So we've seen the fair share of ups and downs.
Right.
But I mean, one thing that I always say is that, yeah, like, the fact that we even survived, you know, and didn't end up like being cancelled or anything like that is really an achievement in itself. But at the same time, like, you know, do I look back and do I want people to only associate us with our YouTube success? Like, do I feel happy and people come and say, oh, last time I watched you on YouTube and that's what I like about you guys. You know, you shouldn't do other things. No, like, I wouldn't want that. Like, I would want to evolve as an artist and all that.
Right.
So, but for you, how do you feel when people say, you know, they talk about your background on the internet and on YouTube and things like that, and that's what they associate you with. How do you feel about that?
I always love meeting the people who are trying to do that. And like, hi, girlfriends.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think it brought so much into my life. Like, it's something that I never would have gotten on if not for Try and Test It.
Okay.
I would never have gotten on the internet because I'm a very introverted person also. Like, so, but I know a lot of people on YouTube are also introverted. But then there is a... This generalization is that's useless. Okay, let me think about how to phrase this. Sure. It introduced me. I think it really introduced me to a whole different world.
Okay.
It introduced me to a different audience, and it really did change my life because it was also like beauty. Introduced me to the world of beauty. Like, I learned so much from testing out so many products. You know, my beauty, my makeup skills improved so much. Exponentially. Oh my god. Before, I could barely even match my foundation, you know what I mean? Like, I learned so many skills doing that, and I tested so many different types of products that I'm pretty good at, like, breaking down whether or not I would like something just by looking at it. You know what I mean? Like, of course, I always need inventions, so I also never really can tell. But because you have so much interaction with, like, things, that I become more familiar with them, and it opened up a whole new world for me.
And you can tell when they say 5 minutes to get rid of wrinkles, that's bullshit.
Correct. But a part of me still hopes.
That's always
because
hope,
you never know how technology will like improve in the future, but highly unlikely. But I would still like give it a chance. I still buy all sorts of random things because I'm like, maybe this will work.
You buy like off TikTok ads?
No, I haven't figured out how to use like TikTok shop, but I buy on like just like Lazada. But I will see things and I'll go look for them.
I see.
So it's like so much fun.
Yeah.
But then also then there's the other thing of like, then we went into like hyper-consumerism, which then became a bit much for me because it was just like, do we need this much things?
Yeah.
You mean there was a phase where you entered the hyper-consumerism?
No, I think that's like
because, society in general.
Like just in general, social media kind of moved very much towards like hyper-consumerism, right? It was just like giant halls and giant like shopping halls and you know what I mean? Like whereas like, I mean, I feel like there is definitely a relationship between like looking at stuff and buying it. But then there's, I feel like it went into a bit of overconsumption almost. It became, as it grew, it became more and more like, oh, how much stuff do
you
have?
Even need this? Like,
right, you know what I mean? And I'm not like, I'm not judging it. It's just something that I observed, right? Like, and then, yeah, so that kind of like shifted. Yeah, but yeah, I love the audience that I found on Try and Test It because like they, I mean there's I always call them girlfriends. I always get comments going like, they're boys who watch this too, okay? I was like, as long as you watch the show, I call you a girlfriend. It's not like, it's not, I know it sounds gender, but it's not. I just mean like, as I, no matter how you identify to me, it's like, hey girlfriend, you know what I mean? And I feel like I really love that audience. They're so lovely, and some of them are like now 20 something. They're like, I started watching you when I was 12. And I was like, oh my god, that's so crazy. Like, so in some ways, there's a sense of familiarity also because we like grew up together, you know what I mean? I mean, through different phases of our lives, but like we kind of like grew up together.
So, you know, just now, like Terrence, you mentioned like the thing about like when we haven't gotten cancelled yet or something is an achievement in and of itself. But one thing about you, given you are in the public eye, you are also not afraid to be vocal about stuff you care about. And like, when did that first start? When you realize like there are things that you care about so much that you want to speak about it? Because I can imagine a lot of people in media, public personalities, being kind of like not wanting to even talk about stuff like. Because I remember it was a few years ago when you made this one video that went quite viral about you being Singaporean and you know like what
I'll be in different places.
And I remember that at that time when Facebook was still a thing, it went quite viral on Facebook. And I mean, even in recent months, you've been quite vocal about issues like what's happening in the Middle East and all.
Was it the Here I Am video? Is it?
Here I Am. There was another one, my 5 minute.
That one also.
Because, and then long time ago, there was another letter to Anton Casey, I think. I think that was like the first time. But I never expected that to go viral. You know what I mean?
Because they went viral, their makeup routine went viral internationally, right?
Yeah, it was funny because that one, it came out and then the show was over and then BuzzFeed picked it up. They made an article on it and then the views like jumped by a lot.
And for context, like maybe you can just tell us like what that video was about.
Right, so it was a video where I'm putting on my makeup, what they would now call a get ready with me. And I then it was like a VO over like my thoughts on beauty and self-love. And like this, I guess in some ways, like the way that we are taught to see ourselves and the way, so what it was that I saw this article about Alec Wick and she was like a supermodel and the answer to a question she was asked, which is like, do you think you're beautiful, really astounded me. It's like, they asked her, do you think you're beautiful? And she was like, yeah, of course. And like, I felt like, I don't know, when I saw it, my brain just glitched. I was like, you can just feel that you're beautiful and you can be so confident about that. And I feel like, working also in the beauty industry, do you realize also, there's a lot of marketing that it has to make you feel like you're less than to make you buy the thing. So it's also driven by this like, oh, you're not good enough, you're not pretty enough, you need to get rid of this, you need to get rid of that, right? And I think that we're also taught to see ourselves in a way that is always like, what can I do to improve me and improve the way I look and be beautiful. And the idea of what we see beauty is, our beauty standards is also something that is quite unforgiving and quite one kind. You know, there's not a lot of space for different types of beauty to be acknowledged. And then I was also talking about like self-love. And I mean, I don't know how to love myself in that sense. Like, and so I ended it going, like, I don't know how to tell you how to love yourself because I also don't know how to love myself. So it's more like an exploration of like the idea of what beauty is and what we're taught beauty to be and how we see ourselves, I think. Yeah.
I remember those went very viral.
Very viral.
Very different time in social media. So
yeah.
I think there's a lot more innocence about social media, right? Yeah. This was pre, like, you know, Facebook hacking and Russia interference and things like that, right? So it was a very different time. But it did have a very big impact on the people who saw it, so that, right?
Yeah. So how do you kind of like balance that? Because I mean, like, I have met some people in media who say, okay, they don't want to speak about these kind of things because they know they are in media,
right?
And it's sometimes difficult to be so vocal about something that you know might alienate some part of your audience,
right?
And how do you go about thinking how do you process stuff like that?
I think for me is like, because when I talk about stuff, I don't expect it to go like viral or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's just like, if I feel strongly about something and I feel like talking about it, then I'll talk about it. Yeah, I think that's just kind of like my guiding principle. Yeah, if I feel strongly about it and I feel like I want to talk about it, then I will. Yeah,
and
it's just like that.
And like that, because like the stuff that you care about that is important, like you feel that it's important enough to talk about, because you feel like maybe there's not enough.
I feel like important is an interesting word because it's like, who decides what's important and what's not? Yeah. You know what I mean? So I can say is I feel like I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't think I can come and tell you like you need to be talking about this or like you need to think about this, but even though I'll feel it, I can't impose that on someone else, right? So like I also, I don't know. I think it's just like, sometimes when you feel something strongly and you feel like you want to talk about it, then you just say lo. I mean, I'm not going to say that I do it without fear, because there are certain things that when you talk about, you might think like, oh, I'm not sure how people are going to react to this.
Yeah.
But then...
Yeah.
But do you feel it as that as a responsibility because you have a platform like you're a public figure, a public persona and everything?
I don't really feel it in that way. I think it's more like, as human beings, I think it's... Oh, I'm going to say important. I feel like as human beings, it's important for us to connect to what is important to us and to give that voice and to give that... and to honor that.
Yeah.
I think for every single human being. I have some privilege to have a platform. I don't know. But that's just kind of like where it ends in that sense. I feel like I also wouldn't be like, oh, because I have a platform, then I have to do this, have to do that.
So you don't feel the pressure, like...
Because the pressure is from who, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because I know I've heard some stories of content creators or people who have large followings. They have said that if they don't speak about a certain issue, their fans like kind of tell them, why are you so silent? Which to me is ridiculous.
Right.
But it is something that happens online. And if you have a big enough following, I can imagine the pressure can be quite significant.
I feel like my take on that has generally been like, if you are in politics, if you are like a representative of a big company, if you are like in a position where you represent people, then I feel like, yes. I think that you do have a duty in that sense, because that's kind of the role, right? I feel like when it comes to this kind of relationship, I generally think that celebrity culture needs to die.
All right.
Yeah. I think we need to stop worship. Not say stop. I think that I really start to wonder or question, like, why we give so much credence to some people over others. Like, this has always been my thing, like, even from the time when I was doing my theater show, Unicorn Moment, it's the idea of what is specialness in the world that we live in, right?
Yep.
We always say special, and when we say it, it means, like, above or, like, more than. Or like singled out and right, and it's like, if you're special, people know your name. If you're special, people will like sing your songs. If you're special, all that. But there is an innate specialness in every single one of us that exists. And the problem is that we don't I feel that the problem is that we don't necessarily honor that enough, and also in the people in our lives, what do you need to do in order to be taken seriously? You should, like, everybody's word should be honored for what it is, right? You know what I mean? In that sense, I mean, that may sound idealistic, but every single human being has an innate worth and an innate value that has to exist outside of what we see success to be, or what we see outside of what the world deems to be valuable or worthy.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I question that thing of like, in terms of like, yes, of course we would like people with big platforms to also care about the things that we care about. But I think for me, the follow-up question would be like, then why am I supporting people who don't necessarily do that, or whose values maybe don't align with mine? For what am I following them for? You know what I mean? And that you can still like people who don't have the same value system, and then you decide how you want to support that, right? Because the people that we support and the things that we support create the world that we live in. Right? So then trying to change other people is also not necessarily the way to. We all know we cannot change other people, right? People only can change if they want to change, right? Like, people could, like, tell me, Shuan, you need to be blah, 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 blah. Unless something inside me shifts and I'm able to hear what you're saying, I won't be able to change that. Yeah, I mean, it's been years of therapy, right? And, like, even my therapist also cannot make me do things that she knows are good for me. You know what? She just has to slowly, painfully wait for me to get there on my own. Because that's just what needs to happen. So I guess in the world that we live in, I think we decide who we want to give voice to, who we want to give support to, who you want to who we want to create, right? Like, not create. Yeah. I don't know the right word for it. But basically, I think that, to give something so much power because of
the following,
right? Like, the thing that I've been so moved by and so like amazed about what's happening now regarding what's happening in Gaza is it's just people around the world, just people. Like, we are all people, we are all human beings, we are all the same, you know, in that sense. Like, we just people who care, just coming together, wanting to change things, you know?
Yeah.
So in terms of speaking about issues, and then also the thing I feel like that when we talk about issues, it's always like that feeling of, oh, we need to save, we need to help, we need to whatever. But looking at what the Palestinians are like, I've seen so many videos of Palestinians where they are just, they hold themselves to such dignity, and they're committed to just living a good life, right? And they're committed to living at given like what they're being subjected to. And I think
no problem. Take your time.
Like, these are not people that need saving. These are people who have had things that we have taken away from them. That's the difference. You know what I mean? Like with any issue, like when we think about, oh, we need to help and we need to save, is we also, I feel like we also need to think about, these are people who have had things taken away from them, and this those things need to be given back. It's not that they are weaker or like less or like anything. You know what I mean? These are people who have had some like stuff that every human being should have. Liberty, freedom, like liberty, freedom, life, a dignified life. These are things that everyone should have. We're not saving anyone. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like when we say give voice to the voiceless, it's not that, you know, it's everyone has a voice. It's that they're just not heard. And the question is, why are they not heard? So we're not, I don't feel like we're helping people in that sense. I feel like this is just part of being human and like believing that everybody has the right to a dignified life. And this, I think, applies across any issue that we talk about. Racism, sexism, classism, ableism, any of those isms, is that there have been things that make people in that group, like their lives, more difficult than someone else. And it's because those things were taken away from them, not because they are weaker, not because they need help. Yeah.
But do you... Sorry. No, I mean, it is a sensitive topic, like, because it is, there's, I mean, even we have covered the news of what's happening. And sometimes we also are like, okay, how should we cover this? Because sometimes we might not be in the best place to comment. So our perspective has always been, what is the Singaporean POV just watching from a distance? And what can be done, how to even think about it? I mean, like, just now you mentioned, you know, the one thing that you've seen is people around the world, right, who have united for just basic humanity, right?
Yeah.
But how do you see the discussions in Singapore? Do you think that it is, constructive in some way? Because sometimes it can get very emotionally charged. And if you go on social media, sometimes it almost feels like the conversation goes away from the issue and it just becomes personal attacks.
Right.
Yeah. So how have you seen the discussions happen in Singapore? Do you think that all the discussions are actually changing perspectives, or is making people more polarized, more extreme, more against each other?
I feel like they're in some ways like two separate questions. Because I feel like it makes sense to be emotional about the fact that an occupying force can just blatantly destroy Gaza in this way. I think it makes sense to be angry about that. And it makes sense to be in despair and sad and emotional that it's been 6 months and nothing's changed. In some ways, it's maybe gotten worse. I think it's interesting, the idea of like being polarized. I sometimes wonder how that word is being used. I sometimes wonder that whether it's kind of like weaponized to bring people to a middle ground that has no justice. Like, let's just everybody calm down and be okay with each other. In the same breath, like, you will be able to say that I think it's okay that you are being bombed to death. And the other person is like, I don't think it is. And like, okay, let's just say it nicely. I don't know where the justice is in that. I don't know where the true
resolve
is in that. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, let's just all talk nicely. You know? So I wonder sometimes whether that is weaponized to kind of make us think that any kind of difference in opinion can be placed on the same plane. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of like examining the narrative around what Israel is doing to Gaza.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people keep saying that Israel has a right to defense. People keep saying that Israel has the right to defend itself. They are also an occupying force.
Mm.
And the occupied territory has a right to defend itself. How come we don't talk about that?
Mm.
You know? Where's the middle ground?
Mm.
What is the middle ground supposed to be? You know?
Mm.
Do we talk about the fact that this occupation has been going on for, like, how long? Mm. You know?
Yeah.
Do we talk about... People talk about the hostages, but they only talk about the Israeli hostages. But do we also know that Israel has so many Palestinian prisoners, and so many of them are, like, in prison without trial?
Mm.
So many of them are kids, and they're imprisoned indefinitely. And when they are, they're also subjected to horrible torture. Like, but the term is prisoner, but if you are held without trial, taken from your home for no reason, are you a prisoner or a hostage?
Mm-hmm.
When you are taken in retaliation to someone in your family protesting, are you a prisoner or are you a hostage?
Mm.
You know, where's the middle ground in this conversation? I'm not really sure where that is.
Like, what are some of the things you've seen that are actually, that have taken good approaches to discussing this in a way that doesn't result? Because I totally get what you mean about how polarizing or mention polarizing is almost making the people who have different opinions feel guilty to a certain extent.
Like, when we talk about constructive conversation, both sides need to come in good faith.
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't saying both sides, but, like, people need to come in good faith, right? There has to be a sense that there will be listening. There has to be a sense that maybe there's a potential for things to change, or, like, that there is, I don't know,
some willingness to find a solution.
Yeah, but if, like, I mean, I think that we are all familiar with many types of conversations where it's like, yeah, I'll listen to you, but the person has absolutely no intention of changing.
Mm.
Like, you know, if you're in a friendship or a relationship where it's like someone is doing something that makes it difficult for you to exist as a human being, and you're like, hey, this behavior is really harmful, and I think that we should talk about it because we need to change. Then,
yeah.
But then the person is there, like, convincing you that nothing is wrong. Then is there a conversation to be had? Yeah. So I guess, like, in general, I'm talking in general, like, when we talk about this kind of stuff, it's like, what, again, what is this, like, so-called resolution or middle ground that we think is a healthy and fair place to be? I don't know. Because I think we are also quite obsessed with, not say obsessed, but we are quite, I think we like the idea of things being nice and peaceful and, like, everyone get along.
Yeah.
But if that happens at the expense of certain people's safety, or it's not fair to certain people, then that's not true peace, right? Yeah. Sorry, I feel like, I don't know if I'm, like, going around in, like, circles and stuff, but, like, yeah, I don't know.
No, I mean,
yeah.
I understand what you're saying, because, like, when we've talked about this issue on our podcast, we've had, you know, Minister Shanmugam come on and, you know, sort of quite clearly state what the official stance is, Singapore's stance towards Israel Gaza. And offshoot of that is, I also have been, you know, asked to speak at panels talking about this issue. And when I go on stage, I'm like, okay, what am I supposed to say, to whether to help the conversation or move it along, or what are we working towards? What kind of resolution are we trying to work towards today? And I felt quite uncomfortable in those situations, right? Where, you know, as like you, as a father, I watch videos of what's going on in Gaza, and it's heart-wrenching, you know.
It's horrible.
You know, like some of the dads there, and the kids, and yeah, those are just situations, like, I remember just poring over those kinds of videos and going downward spirals during that period, right? But yeah, like, when we're told the official line of, like, yeah, Singapore, there's nothing we can do. We're a price taker and all that. It feels very frustrating. Like, you know, like, is there really nothing that, you know, what we can do at, or any kind of influence we can exert as a country and all. But at the same time, yeah, when I hear, when someone really lays out the logic behind Singapore's stance towards these things, it's also difficult for me to say, hey, yeah, you know, that's, you. I'll have to say you have a point, right? You know, like talking about Singapore's relationship with Israel and stuff like that. But it does feel frustrating that sometimes it seems like the conversation is being steered away from the humanitarian crisis going on.
And it's a man-made humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and it's all about the politics rather than, you know, what is actually going on for the people down there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is very difficult to process that.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I mean, like, the difficulty in even trying to wrap our heads around it is actually the motivator for us to want to talk about it. In the sense, like, whenever, I mean, like, when we decide news to talk about, right, anytime there's an issue like that, we know that we are going into a very heavy topic. But we don't want to not talk about it and talk about something a little less difficult or something that is more pop culture related. Because, I mean, our news topics for every episode, we decide almost on the day itself, just to keep it as current as possible. But we try our best to talk about it, even though sometimes we have said stuff that people have called us out on. Because I think there's so many, of course, like at the core of it, the humanitarian crisis, that one is undeniable. But what can be demoralizing sometimes is when you see all the politics around it. But we also don't want to go down the path where when you look at everything, it seems so complex that you don't even want to talk about it. And I think that is a danger, because right now, I think, like what you said, right, it's 6 months, almost 7 months, and feels like nothing has changed. But it's easy to get desensitized.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I won't deny that my emotions now compared to a few months ago is less. And then sometimes I catch myself, I'm like, oh shit, is it so easy to forget? It's been, 2 years since the Russia-Ukraine war started? And now it's almost like, oh yeah, it's ongoing. That's like part of life.
Yeah.
And that is like a horrible thought.
True.
Yeah.
And there's also a difference like in the way that both of those things have been treated.
Yeah, exactly.
By like the major powers and
I mean, in some way, the fact that like just looking at the fact that they are still going on, with almost no end in sight, is it can be very easy to get demoralized, and almost to shut off completely, which is what I think is the dangerous thing that we all shouldn't do. Because if we go down that path, then we just live in our little silo, So even sometimes when we talk about it, I when I'm reading it also, I'm like, what the fuck? It's like, it's so hard to understand. But yeah, it's just trying to make sense of it. It's the little that we can do to try and, I don't know, help people just be aware that this kind of shit is going on.
I feel like at this point, if people are not aware, it's because they don't want to look. I think it's hard to, it's been everywhere. The news about this has been everywhere.
Is there any,
No, you go.
No, I was going to ask, do you think, like, a young Singaporeans or, you know, like, people who maybe aren't so familiar with what's going on, is there something they should do to, you know, get to know more about the conflict or just to understand it better? Like, what can they do?
I think just in general, as a human being, I wouldn't say young or, like, whatever. I think just, like, I mean, look, I'm very new to this, to learning about this. Like, for me, the education only started after October 7th. And I think what really stunned me is how long I hadn't looked for. And when I started looking into what had been happening in Palestine, I was shocked because I found so many things that flew against all, like, anything that I knew about the place, which also wasn't very much, right? Like, I think a part of me kind of felt, because the way people use the word terrorist is like, once the word terrorist comes in, it's like, it's free for all, you can do whatever you want, right? And I think that a part of me never really questioned that kind of narrative, or like, who gets called terrorists and why, and is often tied to Muslims, right? There's a lot of Islamophobia, especially after 9/11. And that has not died down. In some ways, maybe that has, like, been on the rise, right? So we're like, people are, and news media outlets and all that are very comfortable to use the terrorist term in that context. But some of what is happening now in terms of like straight up execution on the streets for no reason. Like the other day, I saw that, I don't know, there's just so much stuff that's happening. Like the indiscriminate bombing, bombing of refugee camps, not allowing aid to come in, torture, documenting of that and putting it up online, like they're proud of it. There's so much stuff that's being done that how come this gets passed off as a natural progression or like a natural thing that happens in a war? And even calling it a war, I feel like it's a bit of a misnomer, because Palestine doesn't even have an army. These are civilians. And the IOF is one of the most well-funded armies in the world against civilians. You've seen video. You see the videos of like this woman who was trying to pull water towards her because she didn't want to risk getting shot.
Yeah.
The things that the Palestinians are being made to do in order to survive is just, you know what I mean? Like, it's horrible. Nobody should have to be subjected to that. And just because you call yourself an army doesn't then legitimize every single thing you do. Like, when I started looking into like the history, into the things that have happened, I really wondered what happened in either my education or my conditioning or in my existence or in my whatever that made it so easy for me to not look at what was happening, you know? Like, and I think what really changed me was following a lot of Palestinian journalists, who, the number of Palestinian journalists who have been killed in this is so many in a, such a short period of time, and they're supposed to be protected. And there are videos where you can see them being targeted. Like, that's not okay, right? We know that. So, like, yeah, so following Palestinian journalists, like, reading books or like the Gaza monologues, reading art or consuming art that, reading art that comes from Palestine, like watching their films. I recently watched Taha, put up by the Singapore Theatre Company. It was really beautiful. I think listening to stories being told by Palestinians has been really life-changing. Because in that you get like you see them as human beings, you know, and I realized that there was a part of me that maybe didn't really see that. Not in a you are less than kind of way, it's just that I didn't see the human being. It's just Palestinians. You know what I mean? Yeah. And as part of a conflict. Opposed to like, these are people, you know, like us. Like, imagine if someone did that to us one day, and then it's just,
But you know, one thing that makes it even tougher to kind of wrap your head around is because what has happened since October 7th is, I think, universally condemned. You know, the amount of people
who... because if it was universally condemned, it would have stopped. We would have had a ceasefire at least.
I would say universally condemned amongst, like, the layperson. Like, when it comes to politics and the International Court of Justice and whatever teeth they have, that's like a whole theatrical bullshit show. But, you know, like the one thing, what I was going to say is that makes it, I mean, tougher to wrap our head around is what's happening to the Palestinian people is terrible. But then there is also the part about Hamas, you know. And like, I know it's one of those things that what happened on October 7th was horrible. It was in some way an act of terror, right? But it was by a group that is not really, it's separate from the Palestinian people, right? But the thing is, you know, trying to make sense of everything, you can't deny that that was done. It's just the retaliation right now has gone to like crazy level. But what I was going to ask is like, there's one thing about understanding what is happening from the Palestinian perspective, but do you think it's also important to understand the history on the other side? Whether you disagree, whether you don't makes you uncomfortable, do you think that is important?
Hamas didn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, that is their biggest selling point. This is like how they use 9/11 to justify everything that happened in the Middle East, right? Mm. Hamas did not happen in a vacuum.
Mm. You're talking about the history of Hamas or just October 7th?
October 7th.
Yeah.
The fact that you have a resistance, you know, we were occupied by the Japanese. Lim Bo Seng, who we studied in school, he could very easily be called a terrorist.
Mm.
But it was an occupation.
Mm.
In an occupation, the occupied are allowed to defend themselves.
Mm.
But we never talk about that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So why... It didn't happen in a vacuum.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, but that's why, like, I think sometimes the conversation... I try to wrap my head around it. Like, what's happening is terrible. And I'm not, how you say, condoning whatever was done. But I think that's why... I do feel that it is important to kind of acknowledge that what was done, be it a vacuum or not, was still 1,000 people being killed, right?
But how about the thousands of people who have been killed by Israel over the years? Like, yeah. I mean, I think there's also a thing of like, okay, I kind of don't really want to go into it because I don't want to get facts wrong and I don't want to like, give people a reason to kind of say, oh, there, you're not an expert, therefore you cannot be saying anything and all of that. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to give it that opportunity because like, yeah, I wish, okay, let me think how to.
And I'm asking that only because it is, not to say that I agree what was done on what Israel did, what Israel's approach is.
Okay, so I think the danger of like that kind of questioning is then we start comparing in order to find who wins this conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that it's enough to just look at the number of civilians who have been killed, which is flies against international law. We know this. And say that this is not okay.
Mm.
Once you start being like, oh, well, but if they did this, then therefore we can kill civilians and therefore we can kill them in such huge numbers. Have you seen the number of babies who are killed? Have you seen the number of... They're testing weapons on Palestinians and then selling them, saying that they've been like battle tested, or whatever the term is, right?
Mm-hmm.
On unarmed civilians?
Yeah.
That I don't think there's anything that is worth kind of entertaining in that line of questioning.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're using that as a shield. And then we don't look at all the other stuff that they've been doing to Palestinians over the years. Do you know that they stopped them from being able to collect their own water?
Mm-hmm.
It's an apartheid state. Like, they built separate roads. They make it difficult for them to move within the country.
Yeah.
This is their own land.
Mm.
You know, before... Palestinians, Jews and Christians all lived peacefully in Palestine.
Yeah.
That happened. And then there was an import of refugees and they took them in.
Mm.
And then, I don't know, the Zionist thing happened.
Yeah.
And then they started taking over the land. They started building settlements. They started
I think
kicking people out of their houses.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that there's no point going further back, because then it becomes like a competition. But I think like it is just something that I personally find challenging. Like, okay, like that, or maybe it's also because I'm trying to understand the situation as best I can. And I do feel that it is important to kind of not say acknowledge, not say like even respect or agree with, just understanding what happened in the series of events. Of course, it's debatable how far back to go, because that one, then it goes down like this comparison thing. But I mean, I think you can, it is possible to condemn absolutely the number of civilians that Israel has killed, while also kind of not say acknowledging that the Palestinians are guilty, is that Hamas did something fucked up. But Hamas is like, it's separate from the civilians.
But IOF has been doing fucked up things for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it didn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Like you say that, you say you acknowledge that, but then you go back again to the point that Hamas did this on October 7th.
But I'm not saying it...
No, but that's where the, you know what I mean? As in like, then it's like, oh, but we shouldn't go too far back. But the thing is like, that I think that's the kind of circularity in the conversations that we have now. And I'm curious where that comes from.
Mm.
I'm curious like why we think that is a good starting point. You know what I mean? Mm. As in like, if we look at it, I think that October 7th, that's when like massive escalation happened.
Yeah.
That would be the focus for me, not that Hamas did whatever on October 7th. And there's also been reports that maybe they knew about. Mm.
Yeah.
The attack was going to happen and they let it happen.
Yeah.
Right? So, I don't know. I feel like all it is, you're just looking at what's happening now. They've destroyed so much of Gaza. Their homes, schools, hospitals, places of worship, you don't need to be destroying all these things. This is on purpose. This is a land grab, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
no, and I'm totally with you on that. Like, I think regardless of whatever happened in the past, the situation now needs to be stopped. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just curious because it is something that I personally am also grappling with. You know, like how to best understand this and kind of just find some hope. And right now, I totally agree that the main focus is the atrocities that are happening and the need for that to stop. And it is very disappointing to see that, yeah, there's no ceasefire. Like there's so much talk amongst the leaders of the world to have a ceasefire, but nothing seems to be happening.
Nothing, yeah. Mm. And in this conversation already, how many Palestinians would have been killed?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but I feel, I think one thing that I try to hold on to that I've been learning from like the people that I watch and stuff is finding a way to hold on to our humanity and to find a way to, it's really that we're not, Palestine is liberating us.
Mm.
Like being, like for me, a big thing is like understanding how easily narratives can be controlled and how easily we can be, convinced into not seeing the other as a human being.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that for me has been like really huge. Mm. And it makes me question a lot of stuff. Like when people say stuff, then I start to like question where is this coming from? Are they telling me facts or are they telling me what to feel?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Are they, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
No, I mean, it is a struggle, right? It is a struggle to talk about this. Thankfully, we have a podcast to talk about it. But it's sometimes even my own personal capacity with friends or anything, I want to talk about it, but I don't know how. You know, and I think it's something that as much as we have spoken about it, it's still every time, yeah, there's just so many things to consider. So many things that are disappointing about how people are acting, how the leaders are acting. But I think, just now when I mentioned that universally condemned, I still stand by it in the sense that in the eyes of the layperson, it's hard not to condemn it. It's just disappointing. Yeah.
I've met people who don't
condemn it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like there are people who are like, but Hamas.
And they say it in a way to justify everything that has been happening.
I mean, it's like, well, Hamas should just turn themselves in, or Hamas should stop whatever they're doing. But something that I saw that day, if Israel stops fighting, this genocide ends.
Mm-hmm.
If the Palestinians stop fighting, there'll be no more Palestinians.
Yeah.
And that's a massive difference.
Mm.
They're not equal. They're not both sides of the same coin. This is clearly a genocide. There's so many like human rights lawyers and scholars who have come out to say that this is a genocide.
Mm.
I don't know why.
Well, it's difficult for it to be unequivocally like kind of labeled as a genocide.
Like, why doesn't this just stop? I don't understand. Like, any other country, if you saw yourself, like, if you saw your people being bombed like this, right? You have no army, you have no whatever. It's just civilians, just like your places of worship, your residential areas, just bombed, you know? Like, would anyone be able to find any justification for that?
Mm.
Why is it when it comes to Palestinians that we bend over backwards trying to like figure out how to have a constructive conversation about it? Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess for me, I'm just confounded by like why that is happening.
Why there's so many kind of roadblocks to things happening?
Like, yeah, why... It's very clear. We just need a ceasefire.
Yeah.
There's no other way around this, you know? And then after that, it's like there's so many Palestinians who are now like, they have no limbs. They're going to have permanent disabilities. How are we going? Like, how are they going to rebuild their lives? Like, their entire, like, everything that they know is gone. How is that going to be rebuilt? Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, Israel is like building more settlements, or like has greenlit like more settlements to be built in the areas that they bombed. How are we not you know what I mean? Like, I don't understand.
And I think that is just the cynicism towards like the political theatrics, because when you look at it objectively, it looks like a no-brainer. Stop, right?
Yeah, but the other interesting thing is they're gonna be like, well, she's not a scholar, she's just an actor. What does she know about this? And then they like start poking holes about things and be like, well, she's stupid, so she shouldn't be talking about this. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And that is like, how smart do I need to be to not care about this?
Mm.
What do I need to study so that I can understand this complex history and sit there and go like, well, we don't understand it.
Mm.
How smart do I need to be for that? What do I need to study?
Mm.
It's confusing. It's so confusing. You have people who are so clearly so freaking intelligent and have so much power telling us that what we're seeing with our own eyes doesn't warrant any kind of response.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand.
Mm-mm-mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because, I mean, that is something that we hear in the news a lot from leaders around the world. And, yeah, it's something that I think we can't stop caring about, even though the news cycle kind of is paying less and less attention to it.
Yeah, but you know, even like the thing is like, regardless of how smart you are, there are human rights lawyers, like scholars, people who have been studying this like for their entire career. They are clearly very smart, but their work is discredited, or like they're not heard, or like they're not given credence to. So then at some point you start to go like, hey, is something else happening here?
Mm.
Is this really about how smart you are about, or how much you know, or about how much you understand about the complexity of this issue? Or is it that there are people who have decided how they want to go about dealing with this and they are just sitting on that, and then you run in circles trying to like convince them or like whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's just, there's no, it's like creating the illusion of a conversation and an illusion of listening. But actually, it's just wait until you just get tired and then just run out of energy, and then all of Gaza is destroyed.
Mm.
And then we'll have that conversation then. And then maybe next time when they write in the history books, I don't even know how they're going to write this down in history books. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's why I think it's super important that the point you made about if you can engage with stories on the ground art from Palestinians and all that is very important, because right now, yeah, you know, a lot of what we see is people start to get desensitized to the violence, or they start thinking of it as a statistic, but they are really, I mean, literally human lives day by day, hour by hour being affected, that we, you know, start to forget because of the news cycle and everything. So, yeah, I've always felt like if I could, I mean, I'm not a scholar on it, but if I were to tell anyone, like, hey, this is how, what we should do is to actually read or hear more about stories of people on the ground, not necessarily just with social media, but, you know, any kind of art or books or anything that people who have gone through these experiences have written about it.
And they also say, like, you know, we should, like, contact our MPs, we should, I don't know. So this is the part that's also scary as a Singaporean, right? Mm. Because it's like, every time it comes to engaging with anything like political, like, I feel like a lot of Singaporeans get scared, myself included. I get scared.
Mm.
Like, that's a terrifying thought.
Mm.
I'm not going to deny that.
Yeah. But I think that's why it's important that, like, I mean, even whatever we've spoken on this podcast, right? I can't imagine, like, it being an easy conversation to have in general. But the fact is, like that's why I appreciate you being very honest about it. Mm. And even, like, whatever we spoke about, it was difficult to talk through. But to me, like, even though there was some roundabout circularity, I think it's still a step. Because even me talking with you and hearing your thoughts is also making... Yeah, I think there was some important things we spoke about. I don't know whether it'll result in anything at all, whether people listening are just thinking, what the hell are these people talking about? But to me, I appreciate that. Mm. I think that's the point of this podcast.
I guess that's the point of, like, I guess, like, us, like, connecting with other people. I think, okay, so the thing is also, like, find community, like, find people who also care about the issue, talk to them, learn from each other. I've learned a lot from, like, the other people who have so much knowledge about what's happening. I think also, like, donations really help if you have the means to donate to the causes that are happening in Gaza. So, for example, Israel keeps cutting off their means to communicate with the world, and that's how we're getting the news. So there is this lady called Mirna Albawi, I think. I need to get that right. Hold on.
I mean, we can put that in the show notes, like, if you have the name.
So there's this lady called Mirna Albawi, and she started a thing called Connecting Humanity, and she has been sending eSIMs to Gazans for them to use, and that's how they can communicate with each other and communicate with the world. So that is pretty crucial. We also have another Singaporean, Gilbert, who runs Love Aid Singapore. So he runs like a food kitchen, I think, and he sends food and I think like some supplies over. So you can also donate to that. There are many other organizations out there you can look for. Just always make sure that the money is going to where you want it to go. And there are also Palestinians online who are also trying to evacuate their families, and it's so crazy, it's so expensive for them to do that. So if you find one, like, also make sure check that it's like legit, because there are also like fake accounts around, but do that. And I think what they ask for is also that we keep talking about them, that we keep sharing what's happening to them, and like don't get desensitized, and to keep engaging, even it is hard, but it's so much harder for them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's this pain is, I learned from this lady called Cold Culture. Her account is called Cold Culture. So one of the things that she says is that this pain is survivable. Like, it's painful for us to watch, but it's survivable and we have to bear witness to what's happening and to just keep sharing that. And I think what I've also found is that I feel that even though we don't see change happening now and we all want a ceasefire, but the tide is shifting and more and more people are changing their minds about it, and more people are starting to see through a lot of the propaganda and starting to understand what's going on and coming together more and talking about it more. So that is also like really, really important. I really hope that the way that this is covered in some of our press changes.
Mm.
Yeah, the way that it's characterized, or like, I mean, I don't, okay, maybe, yeah, maybe we should put it in, but like, yeah.
I mean, like,
there's a lot of stuff that's hard to say, I feel, especially in Singapore.
Yeah, but I mean, I think there's a lot that you shared, and I really appreciate you sharing on a topic that, like what you said, is not easy to talk about. Mm. And everything you mentioned, we can put the links in the show notes.
Okay, so you can follow people like Wizard Bizan. Wizard Bizan, Motes, Plastia. I can give you a link of these people. Like, follow people who are on the ground and follow people who are covering what's happening.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll put all those links in the show notes.
Yeah.
I mean, if people want to like follow you on social media, like,
right,
where can they find you?
Oh, I'm only on Instagram. My Facebook got hacked.
Oh,
oh shit.
Hacked.
My Facebook page got hacked. So I really hope they're not like sending out stuff. I don't know. I tried to get it back, but then, yeah.
But
I don't know what's happening. They also haven't shut it down, so I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. But Instagram is fine.
Instagram is fine, yeah. So I'm Unshuan on Instagram.
So that's you on Instagram. And where can people find out more about the show that you're currently in?
Oh, you can... Where can you find out more about the show? Sistiga. Wildrise website. Okay, so the show that I'm currently in is Wild Rice by Tattoo. No. The show I'm currently in is Tattoo by Wild Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And it is running until the 28th of April.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really great show. Really funny, very insightful, really sharp, very modern. And it is a really great look at religious hypocrisy and scam artists. Which is very relevant for our times now.
Yeah. And I mean, I watched it, like, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I think even the setting, the theater, yeah, it makes for a nice night.
Yeah.
And it's going on daily till 28th April?
Except for Monday.
Okay.
We have two shows on Saturday.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And okay, Monday is cool. Our dark day.
So if people want to find it, they can just Google Tartuff. Tartouffe.
Tartuffe.
Tuffe. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, we also put a link to get tickets in the show notes.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
And now the final segment, something a little, a lot more lighthearted. It's called the One Shook Thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is where we just share something that with our audience that they can experience for themselves. Could be an article, a news article, a video, a restaurant. So we'll go first.
Okay.
So you still have a few minutes to think about something.
Yeah.
Terrence, you got your show thing.
Yeah, mine was just a video from 2 months back where, I mean, the title of the video is Oscar-winning actor and writer Tom Hanks gives the Oxford Union an acting lesson. So actually, Tom Hanks went to Oxford University, and I think I've seen, you know, speeches of from political figures and all that there, but this one, they got Tom Hanks to come in and give like a 18-minute speech about, you know, what it means to be a good actor. And I think it's you know, it's a very stately address that he gave. And I not just for people in our industry, acting or anything, but just in general about life, right? You know, he's someone who's played a lot of big characters, bigger than life characters in his in his lifetime. So he's got a lot of life experience as well to share about these things.
Yeah. You didn't watch on double speed or anything?
No, I just savored it.
Single speed,
yeah. Normal speed, yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
there's this one legendary video by Michael Caine also about acting for TV.
Yeah.
Which is, 15 years ago, which was really good also.
Yeah. So this was from 2 months ago. So very recent.
Nice.
Yeah.
My one stroke thing is a trailer that I saw on David Beckham's Instagram account.
Oh.
It's football. I don't know whether you watch football, Shuan.
No.
Okay, so basically the team Manchester United, you know, 1999 was the first time an English club won the treble.
Okay.
Which is the domestic league, the domestic cup and the Euro Cup for clubs. And there's a documentary about 1999.
The treble.
Oh, okay. And it goes behind the scenes of that season. And it's from the same people that made Beckham, the Netflix documentary.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it's dropping on May 17th. And yeah, it's a nice thing to look forward to, given the current state of Manchester United. Yeah. But I will end there.
I've heard about that.
Okay. So yeah. it's like a ray of sunshine, like a ray of sunshine.
Yeah.
Living
in the past.
Living in the past, correct. Yeah. And what about you, Xuan?
Okay, so there's this film called Wajib. It's a Palestinian film, and it's a father and son who have to come together to hand deliver wedding invitations. And it's a Palestinian custom, and they go around to all the houses and they have like personally deliver them. The son has been away in Italy for a while, and he's come back to carry out his duty, which is wajib. And so the father and son spend a lot of time in the car, and as it happens with a lot of like parent-child relationships in the car, a lot of conversations happen, and you kind of see the different ways that they have dealt with what life has thrown them. And it's a beautiful relationship between the two of them, played by a real father and son.
And where can people watch it?
I'm not sure.
You saw it online or?
I watched it during the Singapore Palestinian Film Festival.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I'm not sure where you can find it, but okay. Do try to look for it. Yeah. It's really great.
We'll put a link to the trailer for sure.
There's probably a trailer online. Yeah.
Then maybe I'll give another one that you can get, which would be, hold on now. There's a show called The Present. It's on Netflix, and a father and his little daughter head out to the West Bank to get a present for his wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
And
that is available on Netflix?
That's available on Netflix.
Cool.
It sounds very simple, but then this is also a glimpse into how very simple things are actually not very simple for Palestinians. In an occupied territory.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, that's an example of Palestinian art, like you mentioned, right?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
But thanks so much, Xuan.
Thank you.
It was a deep conversation. And I mean, hopefully people listen to it, they get something out of it, even if it makes them think or go down the path of understanding more, like if they haven't already.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I hope that I didn't, like, okay, I don't know how to say this, but like, I'm glad that we had the conversation, and I hope that we keep having more conversations and learning from each other. And please let there be a permanent ceasefire soon.
Yeah, ceasefire now.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, to everyone listening, hope you found this insightful. Hope you enjoyed it. And thanks for listening.